I'd like to invite you to open your Bible, the church Bible that you probably have with you there, at page 219 in the Old Testament, as we look at the book of Judges in chapter 7 particularly, continuing in this series that we're doing on these Sunday mornings, which we've called Rude Instruments for a Rude Age, as we go through various important aspects of this book of Judges. And today, as we think about Gideon, we take the theme of the overwhelming minority. People acquainted with the Overseas Missionary Fellowship, people like June Morgan here, may know the story of one of their leaders, the directors of the Overseas Missionary Fellowship, who years ago was on his way to a missionary meeting here in England. And as he got to the bus stop, he realized that he was one penny short of his bus fare. And he gave up in despair. He thought, this is awful, I shall never get there. A penny short, and I've got some way to go. What can I do? And he thought, this is ridiculous. Here have we been in the OMF, trusting God for thousands of pounds every year. Why can't I trust God for one penny? So he leant back against the bus stop shelter, and he closed his eyes, and he asked God for a penny. Just then he felt a tap on his shoulder. It was a friend who was there, passing by. The friend said to him, "A penny for your thoughts." Of course, you can imagine the reaction of the OMF man. He said, "Give me the penny, I'll tell you my thoughts." You know, when something like that does happen to us Christians, and it does happen from time to time, we tend to gasp. Why? We say, "God actually heard my prayer. He knew what I was saying. He was listening. How can he be interested in such an ordinary person?" We can't believe it. So it was with the Old Testament character of Gideon, who was called to God's service, we were studying in our last sermon. Now, Gideon was the very least of an insignificant family. And when the call of God came to him, he couldn't believe it. He had to have a sign. And last week we were reading of how, at a touch from God, remember, the meal that Gideon had prepared for his divine visitor was consumed by fire. Next, it was the fleece. Judges chapter 6 and verse 36. Then Gideon said to God, "If thou wilt deliver Israel by my hand as thou hast said, behold, I am laying a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece alone, and it is dry on all the ground, then I shall know that thou wilt deliver Israel by my hand, as thou hast said." And it was so. When he rose next morning and squeezed the fleece, he wrung enough dew from the fleece to fill a bowl with water. Then Gideon said to God, "Let not thy anger burn against me. Let me speak but this once. Pray, let me make trial only this once with the fleece. Pray, let it be dry only upon the fleece, and on all the ground let there be dew." And God did so that night, for it was dry on the fleece only, and on all the ground there was dew. Quite frankly, a person with a robust faith in God doesn't need special signs from heaven, whether it's a matter of praying for a penny or praying about a fleece. It's no sign of spiritual maturity when a believer exclaims, "I'm putting out the fleece tonight. Give me a special sign." All of this in Judges points to the fact that Gideon was indeed a very ordinary person. The world is full of people like Gideon. As we look at ourselves and look too at our family of the church, we can't believe that God has actually taken on such a feeble-looking show. Gideon in the New Testament book of Hebrews is included in the company described as so great a cloud of witnesses. And that's us. We hardly seem to measure up to the identification. There used to be a pleasantry that was circulated about one of the departments in Moscow's Kremlin. Outside one imposing-looking entrance was the inscription, "Commissar for the Electrification of All the Russias." And underneath on the door was a little sign, "Bell out of order, please knock." Maybe that's how the world tends to think of the church. God's great family, His great cause that he's raised up, when you look at it, it seems so ineffective, feeble, and useless. It's our image, too, if we allow ourselves to be conned by the propaganda coming at us from all sides. Rarely does God's style of performance stun us with brilliance, overwhelm us with incandescent power. This is indeed here a story of victory, overwhelming victory, but our study is aptly called Gideon and the Overwhelming Minority. Gideon, the farmer come general, has become the leader of Israel's forces, chapter 7, verse 1. He's scraping together every single recruit he can get his hands on, because the Bedouin hordes, armed with their new centurion camels, outnumber the Israelites by about 4 to 1. You read about it in chapter 8 and verse 10, how many there were, 235,000 of them. But does God take any great account of statistics? Lesson number one in our study today, I call a lesson in strength. Chapter 7, verses 2 and 3. The Lord said to Gideon, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, 'My own hand has delivered me.' Now therefore proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home.' And Gideon tested them. 22,000 returned, 10,000 remained." If you and I had been advisors to Gideon, we might have drawn his attention, of course, to the opposing Midianite horde. "General, can you see the size of the force you're up against? 235,000. Poor Gideon, he'd been trying not to see them. A crash program of recruitment seemed the only answer. But not in God's opinion. If anything, the army needed to be slimmed down. I don't suppose Gideon reduced his numbers with any great enthusiasm. "Now, men, I sincerely hope, that you're all going to stay enlisted. We've got a great adventure ahead of us, and it's a great life in the Gideons. God's on our side, men. But, of course, if anyone feels they can't quite rise to coming on this campaign, if you don't actually want to do much in the way of actually fighting, well, then you can return home, men. But, of course, I hope you all do the decent thing and stay enlisted. Men? Men? Woomph! They're gone. They don't have that bit quite there, put like that, in the Bible. But they're gone, like a flash of quicksilver. Before you could blink, the army was down to one-third of its size. 22,000 men vanishing in a cloud of dust over the horizon. Had everyone gone? Oh, no, 10,000 were left who had passed the courage test. Next came the caution test, the readiness test. Because God seemed to be saying, "Gideon, your army's still too big. It's like an overgrown cabbage. You've got to slim it down further still. And when you take the 10,000 people down to the river for a drink, I'll tell you which ones to keep." And down to the river, verses 4 to 8, went the army. It was a lovely day. Very hot, and everybody seemed to be complaining of a raging thirst. And that's the test, Gideon. It all depends upon the way in which they drink. Now, you know, if you have no cup with you and you need to drink water, there are two ways of doing it. Either you do what I've sometimes done when I'm cleaning my teeth and I haven't got a mug. You make a cup out of your hand, you know, and you bring it up to your mouth. Or you can get right down and dip your face into the water, being on all fours or flat on the ground, getting everything else wet as well. One was, I suppose, the way of preparedness, your weapons in one hand and using your other hand as a cup, drinking upright. The other was the way of recklessness, lying flat on the bank, your face in the water. Your weapons, well, it didn't matter about the weapons. But you mustn't tell them, Gideon, because that would spoil the whole plan. "Right, men," bellows an officer. "By the right, drink." And suddenly they began to drink. And oh dear, it looked as though every man, jack of them, was drinking the wrong way on all fours, facing the water. "Oh no, there's one who's drinking the proper way. You take his name, Sergeant. There's another one over there. He's another one there, and that one. Tot them up, Sergeant. How many are there?" 300. Very good. An interesting exercise in bringing an army up to its effective strength. This is the lesson of the few. It's a strange lesson. It's been with us for many centuries. You have it with David and Goliath. You have it in so many cases. It's the lesson that strength is not measured by numbers. The group, the fellowship, the church may have many recruits who seem enthusiastic. They may be singing the old hymns with gusto, but all too often we're singing standing on the promises when in reality we're sitting on the premises. And there's a difference. We can be so much dead weight. We had a baptism this morning. Our prayer is that young Timothy will grow to be an effective recruit in the army, in the family of Jesus Christ. We know that it's no mere automatic thing. To be baptized, it doesn't mean that you are then filled with grace and strength and regeneration. He's got to be introduced to that. And our prayer is that he will grow into this Christian faith, which he's got a toehold in now. There's a difference between nominal faith and the real thing. There really is. People reveal themselves in little ways here, just in a drink. And that was enough as a test. There were many battles in the Old Testament, not because God is the author of war, but because we are a fallen rebel race. The age of the judges back in the 12th and 11th centuries BC was a particularly rude and rough age. And God had to use rough instruments in achieving his purposes. So here is the story of a general without an army. And it's a lesson in strength because real strength is not measured by numbers or by material resources. We shall have a major gift day here next Sunday. We pray that thousands upon thousands of pounds will result because we have planned and thought, got our resources together and contributed them in a joint corporate way. We will never know the real strength of our company here. We can't. Only God will see and know what is actually involved and who is actually involved in the praying, the giving, the planning, the studying. It's between him and you alone. How can anybody else know? In this account, God alone knew who could be trusted when the going got rough and the battle began. This is a lesson in strength. It's also a lesson in style. Because as we read on, we come to yet a further reassurance that Gideon required. He was a very ordinary person. He found it difficult to believe that God was involved in the deliverance of Israel at his hand from the Midianite and Amalekite oppression. So comes the night exercise, verses 9 to 14, the secret excursion of Gideon and his assistant to the camp of the enemy across the valley of Jezreel, creeping up to the camp of the enemy, ready to spy out what they could find and come back, they hoped, encouraged. They did come back encouraged. It's nothing very much that they come back with, just an account of a dream told by one Midianite sentry to another. I would have thought that that alone might have warranted a court-martial, because sentries are supposed to be watching, not dreaming. And in his Middle East way, the sentry describes what he saw, verse 13, a barley cake tumbling down and hitting one of the Midianite tents, flattening it in the process. I'm not sure, but I don't believe I've ever eaten barley bread. Have you? I think it's not very nice. It's probably very good for you, I expect, but it's not. I don't think it's very nice. It was Josephus of old who said of barley bread that man can hardly eat it for its coarseness. It's probably full of fiber, but not very nice. Remember, the Israelites had been so reduced by the Midianite raids that this was the level that they were living at now, but only barley bread. So a despised cake of barley bread is seen in the dream and is associated, of course, by the interpreter of the dream, the other sentry, with the Israelites. Oh, he says, that means Gideon. They're the barley bread eaters. Cheap, nasty, round little biscuit. That's what it would have amounted to. Gideon. A little gingerbread man. Gideon. It's a funny style of operating, really. In commenting on this passage, it was C.H. Spurgeon who once said, "If I had to cannonade an encampment, I should not bombard it with biscuits." But this, amazingly, is God's style here. He uses the feeblest of instruments. We read in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 29, "He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength." I guess that there's somebody here who's feeling very frail, perhaps battered by life. We can accept these promises that God gives strength to the feeble and to the faint. Sometimes the feeblest of instruments can halt the toughest of adversaries. We've seen it often. Do you yourself as a believer, perhaps as a new believer, feel vulnerable, weak, ineffective? We take this lesson in style to heart today, because all of us feel as though God could never use us. But the world is full of people like Gideon. You see that man on the Adriatic Sea, rocking in that storm-tossed boat? Why, it's Paul, the great apostle, the man who is to invade Europe with an invasion of love, the message of justification by faith. Here is the man, the spearhead of God's cause. But how frail he looks. He's seasick. He's feeling ill. He has what he calls the thorn in his flesh. He does not feel strong, but God uses him. Look at those 12 apostles. Half of them are rogues and cheats, fishermen. There's not much to them. They're the spearhead of God's international mission to our world. They're not much. They're very feeble. God is using them. Just 10 good people would have been enough to save Sodom and Gomorrah from destruction. Some of us feel that we're in a difficult, oppressive environment, and we feel as brittle as a barley biscuit, a little gingerbread lady, a gingerbread man. Recognize that you may be the key person in that difficult situation, that God is trusting you to be in that, and that we look to him daily for strength to get us through one day at a time, to be there for him in this week ahead. Here is a strange lesson, isn't it, in strength. Here is a strange lesson in style. We also have here a lesson in strategy. We move from the thought of the general without an army to that of the victory without a battle. The hour approaches, verse 16. The famous 300 line up for their equipment. Let's equip them then. Only 300. What should we give them? Right, Sergeant. To each man, one clay pot. Excuse me, General. Did you say one clay pot? That's right. One clay pot, one trumpet, and one torch. Now, I can understand the torch bit, because that's what they always tell me to go to my summer camps with. They would always say, bring a Bible and a torch. So I can understand that. You need a torch at night time. And of course, the torches were different from ours, more like a firebrand. But what would the professionals have said? What a strange army. What a strange strategy. And how would you and I have coped? A clay pot, a trumpet, and a torch. I think I'd have needed three arms to hold that little lot as I staggered down the hillside towards the camp. Well, we know what happened. Something a little like it happened centuries later, for you classicists, at Thermopylae in southeastern Greece in 480 BC, at that narrow, narrow pass, which was only then about 14 yards wide, they've widened it since then, between Mount Oeta and the sea, when Leonidas, the Spartan king, made his heroic defense against the advancing Persian army of Xerxes with a mere 300. Yes, Leonidas had only had 300, and he held that pass successfully. But this here was even more spectacular. Gideon wasn't simply defending. He was on the attack. And the strategy had all been worked out in advance. There was the confidence aspect. He'd needed building up from our previous study with the consuming of that meal, later with the fleece test. He'd been encouraged by the dream. He'd needed signs all along. Well, we're like that, I know. We look for confidence. God's word to us ought to be enough. His promises should be enough for us to have our heads pillowed as we go to rest every night and for us to come into the new day. We don't actually need signs. Gideon was very frail. Little by little, his confidence was built. Then there was the preparation, getting it ready together. See, when we have a thing like a World Vision Day, it can't happen by accident. June Morgan, Michael Elkin of our fellowship here and others have been putting that leaflet together. We've been getting people from the various evangelistic agencies around the world to come and visit us next Sunday afternoon. There's preparation in it. We ourselves have to plan, look at our bank and our budget and say, now what am I actually prayerfully going to contribute to the ongoing work of God's mission in this world? How can I make the biggest possible dent in the kingdom of darkness with my limited resources? It takes preparation. Then there's the initiative as well. As we say, I am going to do it. These are stirring days in which to be living as Christians. If you're listening to the recording of this message, we're in the middle of two great missions in Britain. Mission England and Mission to London. It's lovely to know that there are people preaching Christ's message in different parts of this nation. Nearly every time I ring up a vicar and I say, how are things going? Oh, he says, we're in the middle of a mission. It's wonderful. These are stirring days. Somebody's been taking initiative. We have to do that. In Africa, they are making headway in spite of the difficulties. I've been reading Stephen Neal's brilliant new book, Crises of Belief, published by Hodder, where he looks at the statistics and he says that there is great increase. By the year 2000, Christians in Africa will probably number some 300 million. They'll be the biggest one single section. I want a slice of the action in that. When I hear that in Tanzania they are putting up one new church every 7 days, I want to have an action, part of the action. When I hear in Korea that they're putting up the equivalent of one church every day, again I say to myself, I wish to be involved. I want to be a part of God's strategy. I want my very limited resources and my money to be like that hard little barley biscuit, so feeble looking and brittle, and yet to be a tool for God. The weapons are so different, I know. They're not like the world's weapons. Paul says that in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4. For the weapons of our warfare are not worldly, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. That's what we want to be doing. Bringing God's message and strength to bear upon this world and upon our society. The battle here in this story of Judges 7 is no battle even. Here's the victory without a battle. The blast of the trumpets, the smashing of the pots, the ringing watchword, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon, the resulting chaos in the Bedouin camp, men fighting against men, the camels running amok, the breathless flight back over the Jordan from where they'd come, and the intrepid 300 standing there like little rocks, blowing their trumpets and uttering their watchword. It was the end of a 7-year reign of tyranny. In one fell swoop, it had crumbled. 300 with God, accomplishing in an evening what over 32,000 men could not have been trusted to do. It's a lesson in strength, style, and strategy. Funnily enough, it's always God's way. Let us not be dazzled by the swarming statistics of today's society. Let us not feel dwarfed by the towering power structures that are all around us today. Because the Bible takes a different attitude. Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. Kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. They overcame by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of his testimony. With God, a rabble army, a kind of what we Britishers would call a dad's army, proves to be the overwhelming minority. Because there is this plus factor, if God is in the field. Chapter 8, verse 4, finds Gideon and his men as the surprised conquerors, standing there at the banks of the Jordan. They're graphically described there on the banks as faint, yet pursuing. Very ordinary people. And the world is full of people like Gideon.